From MIT, this is The Energy Initiative. I'm Francis O'Sullivan, and welcome to the podcast. Today, we're talking about the future of electricity markets with Paul Joskow and Richard Smolensee. Paul is Emeritus Professor of Economics at MIT, and Dick is Professor of Economics and Management at the MIT Sloan School.
So Paul, Dick, thank you so much for being here today. It's really particularly exciting for me, actually, because over the last couple of years, I have, of course, been spending a lot of time trying to immerse myself in the changing kind of power sector. And it's, I think we are absolutely in the midst of some very profound change. At least that's coming from a person of my generation. But both of you, with all due respect, have obviously been around a good deal longer. And indeed, wrote a very important book, Markets for Power, back in when, 1983?
82.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let me put it like this. That's how long I've been alive for. And so you've seen a lot of change in the power sector, I suppose, since that book has been published. What I'd kind of like to start out with today is just to kind of ask you for your reflections back at that time when you were working on that book, when you were looking at the power sector, and what really motivated that? Because I think we'd kind of like to move through to today, but I think it's important for us to start with the genesis of that particular work, because I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned going forward from it.
You really have to go back to that period in time, because the context in which we came to do a study that led to the book was the deregulation movement of the late 1970s. They deregulated the airlines, prices and entry. They deregulated interstate trucking, prices and entry. They largely deregulated the railroads. That was more exit and pricing to some extent. And there was interest in, well, why can't we do that for the electric power industry? And Dick and I said, well, because the electric power industry is not like airlines.
We heard that, why can't we do this for electric power, from two economists in the Reagan administration. We go, what? Wait, huh?
And, you know, we said, you mean just stop price regulation and stop any? They said, yes. I said, well, you're going to have real problems with that. But they came back to us and asked us to think about, well, how would you do it? What would you have to do to create competitive opportunities, at least in some sectors? And it's really that question that led us to write the book.
There were sort of two questions, I would say. One is, there were power pools, particularly in New England. And, you know, this is efficient economic dispatch, which looks a whole lot like a competitive market.
Right.
And then there was the question, which we spent a lot of time on, well, what about investment? How would you do that?
And it was the power pools, and there was a wholesale market. It was basically trading, you know, hourly electricity, and
right,
it was
yeah,
competitive, but it was quite clear when you looked at the number, it was basically a short run marginal cost market. You couldn't support investment in that market, and the question was, well, how would you possibly reform the market? What kinds of structural changes? What kinds of contractual arrangements would you need that would, in the long run, support efficient investment?
So there have obviously, since that time, there's been the emergence of a variety of flavors of effort with respect to market structures. And I'm not quite sure whether some have been more successful than others. I'm going to ask you guys to reflect on that. But I am curious, you know, if you can kind of characterize, broadly speaking, the approaches that did emerge through the deregulation process, and the general features that became kind of common across, you know, let's say the U.S. and maybe a few of the international markets as well.
Well, it sort of took a little while, right? I mean, markets started focusing on energy and on efficient dispatch and short-run marginal cost. And then there became the question of, how do you ensure capacity? And Texas has decided that you can do it with energy markets as long as you don't cap the short-run price. Every place else, they've fiddled with capacity markets to try to make up for the fact that they have caps on energy prices. Capacity markets have differed in a range of ways. Paul's looked at them more closely than I, but they've all required a lot of tinkering to try to fill in the missing money.
I think that the design of markets is was not the first step. There was a restructuring effort, which is really very important. Actually, we focused a lot on that in our book. And you know, the general view was that the generation was competitive. It could be competitive in the short run. It could be competitive in the longer run in terms of entry of new capacity. But transmission and distribution were natural monopolies and would continue to be regulated. So the regions of the country that decided they wanted to go with a competitive model also separated generation from transmission and distribution, and in some cases also disintegrated the existing companies to reduce concentration in the in the market. So in California, the major utilities, PG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric, and Southern California Edison, divested their generating plants, but they had to do it in packages so that in the end, rather than there being three generating companies, there were more like 10 generating companies. New England did similarly did that. New York did that. Texas did the structural separation. I don't think they restructured generation, though, to make it more competitive. But that was the starting point, in a way, to the precondition for having competitive markets. And I would say that there was a lot of focus on creating competitive energy markets and ancillary services markets. And the model that's emerged almost everywhere in the U.S. is a day-ahead and day-of bid-based, security-constrained bid-based market that integrates the pricing of energy and ancillary services with the management of congestion. That's the market in New England. It's the market, PJM's market. It's the market in New York. It's the market in Texas now, which has locational pricing, and it's now the market in California. So I think that that market design has taken over. As Dick said, there was very little attention to what we thought was the most important question from an efficiency perspective, was how do you attract entry? I think some of it was actually bad economics. There were people who just didn't get it that to support capital investment, you either had to have capacity pricing or contracts or very high prices during some hours to be able to cover the capital costs. And there was a long literature in planning for electric power systems that would have led you to that conclusion if you really had incorporated it.
But nobody really looked at that literature. I mean, it's funny. We thought that the energy market would be relatively simple. And it took a little while, as California illustrated, to make it work, but it has proven to be relatively simple. Capacity has been rather another matter. The other thing that happened, of course, was the development and evolution of the independent system operator regional transmission authority model. It's a strange model, but it's developed, and it seems to mostly work.
Yeah, so an alternative model was the UK model, where the independent system operator was the grid operator.
Right.
And I think that had certain advantages because the grid operator also could manage the transmission system, maintain it, and invest in it.
Yep.
Whereas the ISO model kind of separates that, and the ISO kind of does planning and then in one way or another tries to induce the transmission owners, of which there are many in many of these areas, to make investments that to serve the collective good.
So this brings up kind of an interesting feature from my point of view. So if I look around the world at the plethora really of kind of models that exist. So on the energy market front, you guys mentioned the nodal model that we generally rely on here. Most other countries do not use the nodal model.
Right.
Now, coming from the electrical engineering point of view, the nodal model makes a lot of sense, but it adds a lot of complexity.
It was also originated at MIT, so we naturally have
this is very true.
Sympathy for it. Yeah, it also makes physical sense.
It's not just the nodal model that's been rejected in most other places. It's also the idea that you basically have a central market that was managed by the system operator. So the UK market, which began in the 1990s, was a central market. You put in bids, the system operator and the grid owner had some incomprehensible computer program that took the bids and solved for some kind of least cost solution and then set up a dispatch and did the dispatching based on prices. Yeah.
So let's talk then a little bit about kind of now where we are today and where we're possibly going. So I'm going to kind of contend that power markets broadly have proved reasonably effective to date. And I'm curious on your perspectives on this, but they seem to function reasonably well. Certainly, it does feel that the missing money problem, the question about incenting new entrants to build capacity and so on, has been an ongoing challenge. But nonetheless, you know, the lights have stayed on more or less constantly. And therefore, it feels like that the system has worked reasonably well. We are now, of course, though, entering into a kind of a new era in the power sector as we see the kind of proliferation of renewables, intermittent renewables in particular, and resources that have a very different economic characteristic than many of the resources these original markets were designed for.
I guess I'd argue that while intermittency is important, it's also important that in particular solar, but also wind, as long as production is subsidized, have very low marginal cost.
Yeah.
And when you have an economically efficient dispatch with marginal cost pricing, you all of a sudden have no money in the energy market.
Right.
So all of us, not all of a sudden, but pretty significantly, the energy market doesn't support investment. It may have been inadequate in the past to support investment, but it becomes more inadequate now. And the investment in the renewables tends to be subsidized or required.
Right.
So that you need fossil capacity to deal with intermittency, and you don't get it out of the energy market. So you have to figure out how to get it.
You know, I agree with that. I think that the missing money problem is going to become more and more important, because especially as solar is diffuses into the market in high volumes, you just get a lot of hours during the day when you have very, very low prices. And those prices not only aren't high enough to support conventional generation, they're not high enough to support renewable generation, which
Absolutely. Then right. Is
financed basically outside the market through through subsidies or contractual agreements with distribution companies. So I think the whole issue of how you generate quasi-rents, short-run margins to cover the capital costs of these facilities, if you're going to do it through the market, becomes more and more challenging.
We heard a seminar last spring here at MITEI. A young woman who was active in solar development made the point that nobody puts a solar project through the capacity market. They're all funded long-term with contracts with load-serving entities that have renewables obligations. And she said, I love markets. These markets don't work. What are we going to do?
Right.
I think that's the $64 question.
The rise of renewables, and you've mentioned this, Dick, obviously there has been a dramatic reduction in the costs and so on. And so certainly there are instances now where kind of the economic competitiveness of these resources is kind of drawing them into the market. But in addition, of course, a lot of the momentum that these resources now have has come about because of mandates, policy mandates and so on, that come down through states typically. And those mandates sit on top of generally the power market structure. And from my point of view, looking at that, it feels like there is kind of tremendous potential for a lot of distortive effect. Is it fair to say that? I mean, are we at that point now?
It is and it isn't. I mean, the fact that solar is being pulled into the market by government policy, the policymakers would argue that's not a distortion. That's a response to climate change. That's a response to CO2 emissions and our desire to kind of undistort.
Right.
We don't have a price on carbon. We don't tax the bad thing, so we subsidize the good thing. But it then makes it hard for markets to work, and the FERC has wrestled with this. You know, you have some resources that are subsidized by the state competing in a capacity market with other resources that aren't subsidized.
Right.
How should that work? And they don't have an answer.
And I think some of these challenges have been hidden by the fact that there is this large stock of existing dispatchable fossil generation.
Yes.
That basically the wind and solar could free ride on them in a sense.
Yep.
They provided the backup services. They weren't getting, they were getting paid enough to cover their operating costs, but not much in the way of covering their, what would have been their ongoing capital costs.
Right.
And they're exiting the market slowly.
Yeah.
And at some point, enough will exit the market where this issue is going to have to be confronted. How are we going to incent storage, backup generation to come into the market given the current structure that we have? And I think the current structure is unlikely to work. I see this whole thing potentially unraveling where you have mandates for wind and solar, subsidies, required contractual arrangements with distributors, then you're going to do it for storage, then you're going to do it for rapid response gas turbines, and before long we're going to have two markets, a contract market and an energy market.
I think we're getting there. And you see patches on the current system when utility A or generating entity A says, we're going to retire this plant. And the system operator says, you can't retire that plant. We'll pay you to keep that plant going.
Right.
Well, what kind of market is that? That's central planning.
And there are more and more of those.
Yeah.
And does it make any sense to have this period of very low energy prices and very low capacity prices where they have capacity markets and start having the nuclear plants retiring,
right,
which are zero emission carbon emitters,
yeah,
while at the same time you're subsidizing more zero carbon emitters to come into the market for exactly that reason? But that's kind of what's happening.
It seems to me the answer has to be you're putting patches on patches to try to preserve some sort of semblance of a market. The question is, are we institutionally and politically capable of biting the bullet and saying the ISOs really need to do integrated resource planning at a regional level and think about the most efficient way to have the capital stock they need regionally, have debates about what that capital stock is, procure it efficiently, but instead of trying to tweak a market design that is plainly not working? That's a big leap politically, but it may be a necessary leap.
It's also easier to do in the states that have single state ISOs like New York and California and Texas, where the public policies and the behavior of the ISO can be coordinated in many dimensions. But think about a large ISO RTO like PJM with, you know, states on the one hand like New Jersey, which wants to go all green, and Maryland, and states like Ohio that don't want any part of that. How are you going to harmonize all of these different public policies in one electric power system? I think it's a real challenge for the multi-state ISOs.
Right. So it certainly feels, I mean, today that these issues that both of you have just been articulating, they're beginning to rise to the surface across the various ISOs and RTOs to different extents in different systems and so on. But people are getting worried. I recently was speaking with a wind developer very focused in Texas who is extremely worried about the kind of growth of solar, which is going to be quite aggressive in Texas shortly, and the impact it's going to have on that particular market. And so I'm hearing more and more people asking, really, okay, so we feel like there's a problem, but how do we begin the process of going about putting in place, whether we'll use the term markets or at least new institutional paradigms that are fit for purpose, given the new technologies we have at hand.
You know, the people in the Southeast, Duke and Southern, can kind of smile at this, right? Because they have the institutional setting.
Right.
You know, they can do this as central planning. I have a son living in Hawaii, so I follow developments in Hawaii. Hawaii has a lot of solar, more solar proportionally than California. But they don't have a market. So the utility and the regulators sit down and figure out what needs to be done, and then they do it. In California, you know, trying to cobble together a mix of markets and mandates and subsidies and God knows what is harder. Not that Hawaii is a model.
Sure.
But there's more flexibility in that system than there is in one that's supposedly market-driven, where you have to change the market design as the world changes.
Well, that thing kind of leads me back, I suppose, to where we started. So when you guys were reflecting on or initially, you know, writing your book and the principles that you were kind of trying to draw out, if you take that and now you reflect on where we are today, are there things that have surprised you in terms of how things have played out? Or do you really feel like that in general, actually, what you had in mind at the time still holds, it's just that we're going to have to kind of click refresh a little bit in order to kind of put in place that more fit for purpose paradigm?
You know, I'm not sure we had anything specific in mind. I think we paid much more attention to the challenge of attracting investment. We thought the problem of creating competitive short-term energy markets would be simple. Actually, it wasn't as simple as we thought. And I think our favorite model was one in which basically you had distribution companies having a plan, taking competitive bids, and you get competition that way from suppliers with some kind of incentive-based contracts. And then those would be taken by the system operator and dispatched economically. That was the model we thought that would support investment. But it was not a model that was adopted here. There was a view, no, the short-term market would cover it. And I said before it was bad economics. Going back to the late 40s and 50s, one thing everyone realized, if you only paid the peaker its marginal operating costs, you couldn't cover the cost of the peaker.
Yeah.
And yes, that undermined the whole equilibrium of the system. And somehow that got lost in all of this restructuring.
You know, I went back and looked at the book a few months ago, and it was all about what kind of long-term contracts. You'd need long-term contracts to finance new capacity. So what kind, who would do them? And there's a sentence, which I could probably find again, where it says, we doubt the ability of market prices to provide adequate guidance for investment decisions. Well, nobody else doubted that, really, for a while. But I think we're sort of back to the future in a way. I mean, if you look at that book, it says, we need intelligent decisions about the capacity mix and long-term contracts to enable financing. Here we are.
And I think maybe the worst thing is to back into this with your eyes half closed. If we're going to a system where we're basically going to be doing integrated resource planning again, we're going to be deciding on wind and solar and batteries and quick start and fast response generators, and we're going to be contracting those up to get them and keep them in the market, maybe we should just recognize that and start putting into place mechanisms to make a system like that work efficiently, rather than waiting until we've driven all of the incumbent capacity out of the market.
Yes.
And then trying to figure out how we're going to make it work.
And again, if you compare the Southern Company, which isn't aggressive on renewables, but take Hawaii. You compare Hawaii Electric with California. They're doing integrated resource planning and vetting the plan with the regulator. They have a 100% carbon-free goal as well, and they have handicaps because of size that California doesn't have. But it just seems smoother. You know, they've had their hiccups, but it just seems smoother without trying to tweak a market. Let's just see what we want, what we need, and let's do it.
Well, the other element in what you've just said there too, Dick, that I kind of would like your just brief reflections on is the fact that, again, going back to the original, you know, restructuring and in particular to the breaking up of some of the incumbents initially during the restructuring process, the focus, of course, was on generation, and that made a lot of sense. But that was in an era when certainly the demand side was not really viewed as having a whole lot of flexibility. And today we are entering a very different world, obviously, where there is obviously through digitization and a host of other things, a potential for a lot more of that dynamic. Have we found ourselves today, particularly in the RTOs and ISOs like here in New England, in a situation where we have one hand tied behind our back in terms of kind of our ability to actually bring, you know, a dynamic part of the system to bear and to kind of leverage that in delivery of the overall system?
Certainly all the ISOs have tried to accommodate demand side and recognize that demand is more flexible.
Yeah.
And especially in areas where there are competitive retailers, they see this as a service that they can sell both to retail customers as well as into the market. So I think we're going to see that happening. The fact that we're seeing more and more distributed rooftop solar especially creates opportunities for on-site storage. Mm-hmm. With storage, you can make heating and air conditioning much more flexible. So I think those opportunities are coming, and the ISOs have thought about how you integrate those into market mechanisms. You know, there are challenges as to what's the baseline and how do you make this work? Are we really willing to charge small customers real-time prices, which sometimes could get very high? My view on that is that's what competitive retailers are going to do. They're going to offer you a deal and say, we're going to give you a fixed price, but in return for that, you have to let me manage your load during the summer, 12 summer days and 12 winter days.
Exactly.
I'm not going to freeze you out, but I may curtail you for some period of time or put you on some kind of rotating schedule. I think that's one of the potential benefits of retail competition. Other than that, I've never seen any great benefit to retail competition.
I think with all the smart meter deployment, there's enormous potential to do that. But you look at retail competition in Massachusetts, and it has not moved in that direction. And I'm not sure it has in many other places. I do want to clarify something I said a few minutes ago. I think the vertically integrated model may have advantages in terms of flexibility. But the whole argument for restructuring was efficiency incentives in constructing generation
sure.
and operating generation. Those are still there.
Yeah.
So the question is, you decentralize what you can decentralize, you centralize what you have to centralize. And that's the right approach. It's just being a little clear-minded about the need to centralize some things that we haven't.
And the pressure for restructuring, and one of the oddities of it, most of the restructuring
right.
and movement to comp took place in blue states.
Right.
Yes.
These were not the states that were wild about free markets in general, but they were reacting to the high costs of nuclear plants
uh-huh.
that had been put in, and some of the high costs of public policy interventions, the way they applied PURPA in terms of promoting cogenerators with the creamy contracts. Energy efficiency programs, the costs got put on the wires. And part of this was an effort, the proponents thought, is that they would lower prices and put more pressure on the costs of building and operating generating facilities. And I think to some extent that's been successful.
You think so?
Yes. There is much more pressure on merchant generators
sure.
to perform
yeah.
efficiently.
Yes.
And Dick mentioned the Southern Company, which has more flexibility, but they're also completing two of the world's most expensive nuclear power plants.
Sure.
Which their customers are going to pay for.
Yeah.
yeah.
And it's kind of that
exactly.
tail risk that I think people were trying to avoid.
Absolutely.
Well, the only reason I asked that question, do you think so, is that here in Massachusetts or in New England, we still have ultimately the end user pays very high rates. So on the wholesale side, there has been a lot of, I suppose, you would argue, and I'm quite happy to take your point, that there has been efficiency gains there.
Yep.
But of course, we've had a lot of other charges come online, some of them due to mandate and so on, some of them due to efficiency and other issues. And I still think there's a perception that in these markets, electricity, at least at the end user point of view, electricity is still expensive.
Well, if you live in California, that perception is
and is real. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, look, it's true. I haven't done the numbers for 2018, but in 2017, the average energy price in the New England ISO was $35 a megawatt hour, 3.5 cents a kilowatt hour. My retail price was 12 cents a kilowatt
sure.
hour.
Sure.
So how do you make up the difference? Well, there are losses. That's about 10%. There are capacity charges, which at that time was maybe another 20%. Then they offer you a 2-year fixed price,
and that's
got to be hedged.
Yeah.
And not only they hedge the price, but they hedge the quantity. It kind of adds up.
Yeah,
it would
yeah.
be if someone could offer me, we'll charge you the real time price plus 10%.
Uh-huh.
I would be bearing much more risk, but it would be a lower price.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. The final topic, guys, that I'd like you just to reflect on a little bit is something now that I think is coming down the pike very rapidly, and that's the issue of storage. And we've mentioned storage a few times here. Storage feels to me like a technology, when we say storage, I suppose specifically things like batteries and so on, but feels to me like a technology that has the potential to be kind of profound in altering and adding flexibility to the system and so on. But it also feels like a technology that's going to be very difficult to integrate into the markets, or at least feels that way to me, because it seems like there are a lot of things that storage can do, some people claim simultaneously, and you know, how you actually kind of integrate that into existing systems feels complicated. But I'd love your thoughts on it, and I know you're thinking a lot about that now as you're thinking about the evolution of the system in general.
Well, and we're thinking about it in the context of the ongoing future of storage study. And I must say, I don't know where Paul is. We haven't talked about this much. But part of me says, wait, it's not that hard. We've got markets for the things that solar does that are market-driven, and we have needs of distribution utilities for storage in the distribution systems. Mm-hmm. So how hard can it be? And then the other part of me says, no, it's the simultaneity and the multifunction and the layering that makes it hard, and I'm not sure I know how to think about that. So I can't tell at this stage. I don't know where you are, Paul.
I think there are some challenges here, but I think maybe we've overcomplicated mm-hmm. it.
It's possible.
And I'll go back to some of the discussion we had before. If you look at the numbers for California, which now has a lot of solar, you see that at the end of the day, the prices go way up for 4 hours, basically.
Yeah.
And that creates an arbitrage opportunity. You can buy during the day and you can sell during that period of time. You can use batteries, which are very, very fast. And we come back to the question I raised before, is the margin large enough to support the cost of the batteries? And the answer today is no.
Right.
And that is going to be resolved either by coming up with some new way of pricing that service, or through subsidies, which is what's happening now, subsidies or mandates, or potentially large reductions in the costs of those storage devices. And Dick is right, there is kind of a simultaneity problem here in that you're not going to see the large margin for the four-hour ramp until you have a lot of solar in the system in particular. But you can't have a lot of solar in the system without having this backup capacity, or else it's not going to work properly. And that's why I think this missing money problem is going to become more and more important, because if we don't let the prices get really high on some of these days when you really have to ramp a lot very, very fast, you're never going to be able to support it with energy prices. Maybe there'll be a capacity pricing mechanism for it. At least we're looking at right now, it's mandates that are coming through.
But it's mandates without, at least as I read them, without much notion of what storage will do. It's just that, well, we've got intermittent generation, so we're going to need some storage, so put some storage in.
Yeah, and I think we've been a little bit misled with the fact that a lot of the existing experiments, I'd call them, with storage have found a lot of the benefits are on displacing grid investments. The fact that grid investments and storage are potentially a substitute, it's also true of generation.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got congestion, if you've got a pocket, one way of solving it is to build more transmission. The other way is to put generation in the pocket. And in that sense, it's not really that much different from generators.
Or you put storage in the pocket.
Yeah. Or you put storage in the pocket in this case. But the incentive problems in the markets we have are the same in both cases. If we don't have high prices inside the pocket to attract entry of generators, or we build the transmission capacity too soon so the prices are never realized, you're not going to get a market solution.
All, and this goes back, Frank, to your earlier point about pricing. I mean, there's a nice study, at least conceptually nice study, about Hawaii that says, well, how do we do 100%? What would the cost be? Well, if we can price dynamically, there's all kinds of non-fancy storage that can be done. You can pre-make ice for air conditioning. There are opportunities for pumped hydro because of the terrain. You don't need new high-tech batteries to cut the cost enormously if you provide the economic incentives by getting the prices right. We tend to think of storage as really advanced technology, super high lithium stuff. There's a lot of ways to store. And if you get the prices right, you provide incentives to do those things as well as to use the fancy stuff.
And on the demand flexibility side, at least for residential and small commercial customers, it is air conditioning and heating that are both the largest fraction of consumption, also the most flexible.
Yeah.
And we know that consumers like air conditioner cycling programs.
Yes.
If you give them a discount, you tell them, you know, on some number of days, we're going to cycle your air conditioner on for half an hour, off for half an hour, and you get a discount. Well, they like that. So we know there's a potential for doing that, but we haven't created the right incentive structure to make that work.
I learned some time ago that the Miami airport buys it wholesale, because I got stuck there overnight missing a hurricane. And by 5 o'clock in the morning, it was 45 degrees in that airport. They clearly bought it night, they chilled it down, and it made perfect sense, except it was really cold.
Deacon Paul, this has been fantastic. I could certainly sit here and kind of ping silly questions at you guys and learn a lot for a lot longer. But we'll wrap it here. I will say this, though, you know, just in reflecting on what you both said, certainly there's a sense of back to the future, I think, in many respects. It's all change again, and in many respects, it's all the same. And I think the all the same is really ultimately one that I'm sure you as economists would appreciate, and that is we should focus on getting the price right. That still remains the core principle, and I'm sure in all of our work going forward, that will continue to be a message that that we're going to be keen to kind of deliver to the broader world. So thank you so very much indeed. It was an absolute pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Show notes and links for this episode are at energy.mit.edu/podcast. Tweet us at MIT Energy with your questions, comments, and show ideas, and subscribe and review us where you get your podcasts. From the MIT Energy Initiative, I'm Francis O'Sullivan, and thanks for listening.